All right, I'm going to get back to the stars. Well, we still got some time. And you all can go back to your notes. You could have the book that we gave away, The Glory of the Stars, by E. Raymond Capps. You'll find on pages 20 and 21 a summary of the major constellations and the minor constellations. One of the things I like about Capps' diagrams is he apparently obtained the permission to utilize the pictures with the black background that's come out of some other studies on this subject, and they photograph better than the white paintings with dark lines. Now, the most ancient Egyptian zodiac gives you the key. Modern zodiacal charts start at a different place. The most ancient charts start with Virgo and end with Leo. The one crosshair intersection in God's revelatory plan that is the dual witness that confirms is the way the pyramid, centuries before man was supposed to know any of this, plots the diameter of the earth, the shape of the earth, the center of the landmass of the earth, the distance to the sun, and embraces all the three systems for keeping the year, the solar and the lunar, and the anomalistic year that is far beyond the calculations of primitive man, demanding an understanding in order to really see what the pyramid builders could comprehend, an understanding of that precession of the equinoxes that has to do with the wobble of the earth on its axis. It is lined up with Draconis, that constellation, and lined up by crosshair plotting with a star in the Pleiades, and in 24 to 28,000 years, closer to 26,000 to be exact, those two same stars would only line up again once, and the North Star, Draconis, was shining right down that descending passage at that particular moment when the scored lines inside the descending passage, crosshair lined up with the Pleiades. And in these two witnesses, you understand that the builder of the pyramid had an equal knowledge of the stars and aligned the pyramid with a knowledge of the universe that we're only now coming to comprehend and come to grips with. And the mystery of the Sphinx in front of the pyramid has puzzled people for years. It's very simple. The head of a woman, the body of a lion. That head of the woman for Virgo and the body of the lion for Leo. And in the most ancient Egyptian zodiac, the Sphinx is placed in that circle of the zodiac between Virgo and Leo, and positioned in such a way to let you know the key from most ancient times for interpreting the zodiac is start with Virgo and end with Leo the lion. And starting there, the pattern of God's revelation breaks into three broad sections. The first four have to do with the revelation of the nature, the person, and the ministry of the deliverer. The Virgo sign is the young woman lying prostrate that in the most heathen myths, still this virgin woman is pictured exactly that, a virgin. In the most sensual and impure of ancient mythology, Virgo's purity remained intact. And yet, paradoxically, the symbol of the virgin woman is mixed with the symbol of fertility. An absolute paradox. A virgin conceiving, bearing the seed in one hand and the righteous branch in the other hand. Now, these concepts, as taught by the descendants of Seth, were ultimately taken, and as the rebel Nimrod and Semiramis would twist the truth of God's incarnation into Satan's substitute. These truths were twisted and come out in the myths of ancient languages and ancient cultures, but the lie cannot cover up the truth. As Joseph Sykes has said when he visited that Islamic temple that was a converted Christian church in Istanbul, they had painted over an image of Christ, a picture of Christ rather, but the paint couldn't cover up the picture that was underneath. The beginning of the message in the skies is a young woman, virgin, that will bear the righteous seed and bring forth the righteous branch. Now, surrounding the basic truth of each constellation are the supporting truths of the constellation. It has nothing to do with size. It has to do with position in the equator of the room that the earth's going around the sun. I'm not going to spend a year teaching on the stars. I have a simple message to get across before I get back to teaching on the pyramid and on the prophecies of Scripture. God always has been and will always be in control. And when God can write this record in the magnitude of the universe, He can take care of us in spite of a few bureaucratic monkeys that don't know how to use law books. Surrounding Virgo are the three supporting constellations, God's revelation. Now, some people are going to find difficulty with the same personage of God through His Son being portrayed in several different images. He does that all through the Bible. To get across the truth of salvation in one of the offerings, you bring two pigeons. You kill one, you take the blood of it and sprinkle it on the wings of the other and set it free, because it takes two to teach the truth. Christ was both. On the Day of Atonement, you bring two goats. You offer one to God. It's slain. The other stays alive. You confess the sins over that goat, put it in the hands of a responsible man. He takes it to a wilderness where nobody inhabits the place. And it takes both of them to portray what Jesus does at Calvary, dying for our sins, but carrying them to a place where they'll never be brought up again. At the sacrifices of the Old Testament, you had an offerer, that was the sinner. You had a sacrifice. You had a priest performing the offering. At Calvary, Jesus was the sinner, taking our place as the sin bearer. He was the sacrifice. He was the perfect parts of the sacrifice that were preserved to show His value to God. And He was the parts of the sacrifice that became the object of God's wrath. And He was also the high priest making the offering. But in the Old Testament, you could only portray that by a multitude of images. So as you look at the galaxy of the heavens, God portrays the same truth in different images as you make the trip. In the sign of Virgo, Christ is the seed and the righteous branch. Unlike the distorted lie that elevates the woman above the child, the supporting decans, from which we get deck on a ship, which is divisions, coma, the child, whose very name means the desire of the ages, and that is shown in astrology as the child on the mother's knee. Satan's lie elevates the woman. She couldn't stand to her feet until the child came. She's prostrate and helpless, bearing the seed. Coma, the child, is the desired one of the nations. He becomes the two-natured being, the centaur, looked at with all kinds of disgust to Christians who view mythological symbols an object of sinful worship, as they turn the creature into the object of worship instead of the God who's communicating. But there's a simple message in the centaur. And as all mythology has the virgin woman pure, likewise the centaur is always seen as that helper of mankind who is rejected by mankind, not pleasant to look upon, hated by both man whom he comes to help, and the gods that are none other than the false gods, Satan's cohorts. He comes to help. He is wounded by an arrow that's not intended for himself, and out of his love for another, takes the death that someone else deserves, having helped and healed. And as a reward for what he's done, he's taken by the gods and placed in the stars. But the essence of the centaur, two-natured one. You know, I don't like very much man being represented as the tail end of a horse. That's the most possibly... I cannot conceive of a better illustration of sinning man. God calls him a wild-ass man. That's what the sinner's called. And the stars, that real wisdom. He's the right end. Just think about it for a minute. It's very, very true. But the meaning is the two-natured one. The righteous seed, the righteous branch, born of the virgin woman, becomes the desire of the nations, the two-natured one, going forth to help, receiving the arrow that's intended for someone else, giving his life, though he's immortal, giving his life that someone else may have it. All that's in the myths, distorted to be sure. And the myths will not lead you to God, but go behind the myths, God was saying it all along. From a virgin woman will come the righteous seed, the righteous branch that will be the desire of all the nations, that will be a two-natured person that will come to help man, and though immortal himself, will give his life for the sake of another, and as Philippians 2, will be given a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow. He is Boötes, the next little decan, all of which elaborates this coming one. Boötes is the harvester and the shepherd who tends his flock, walking. Now, later astrology calls them bears, but the earliest astrology has him not tending bears, but a flock. He's the great shepherd and the great harvester. Bursting on the scene at the opening of the galaxy as you go through the year, the message is in the stars, a virgin woman who bears the righteous seed to become the righteous branch, the desire of all the nations, come with a child on the knee, the two-natured being who will become the great shepherd of his sheep and the harvester out of this world. You immediately go to the next chapter of the first act of the heavens, Libra the scales. Immediately on the scene, he confronts the scales of righteous judgment. That forces him, having confronted the scales, to look at the cross, because man is weighed in the balance and found wanting. And the one that comes to redeem us looks at the scales, must confront the first decan, which is the cross, become Lupus, the victim, in order to obtain the Corona Borealis, the crown, the northern crown. All of that is written. I'm frustrated at this moment because I want to camp on each of these and redo them because it's been so many weeks since we've done it. But let me keep sailing along because we've done this already. The righteous seed who became the desire of the ages, the two-natured one who was the shepherd and great harvester, confronting the scales, pays the price at the cross, becomes the victim, obtains the crown. Immediately, the conflict and the struggle is confronted in his deliverance work. Scorpio, the third sign, that symbol of Satan, but the decans around it show a serpent, another symbol of Satan, with his head about to take that northern crown, the Corona Borealis, that he has obtained. You have then Orpheus, the man struggling with the serpent, keeping his head from getting the crown. And as you look at the feet of Orpheus, one foot is on that bright star that is the heart of the scorpion, and the other foot is lifted, having been stung with the tail of the scorpion. And perfect fulfillment of Genesis 3. He then passes in the Decans to the imagery of Hercules, the mighty man, wounded in one heel, the other foot over the dragon's head. One hand he holds the golden apples, which is none other but a symbol of the tree of life, and the three-headed dog of hell in the other hand, where he's taken his head and the uplifted club over it. We have him doing the work of wrestling with Scorpio, the serpent, and winning every time. The last sign, which is a revelation of the person of the Redeemer, has Sagittarius again, another name for the two-natured being. Only this time, his bow is drawn with an arrow pointing straight to the heart of Scorpio. The Decans support his work of redemption. He is Lyra, the eagle, holding the lyre in triumphant gladness. He seizes joy. He dumps the altar of fire down toward hell, and Draco, the old serpent, is suddenly seen as winding himself in horrid kinks and contortions as Sagittarius victoriously obtains the triumphant gladness, dumps the fires of hell onto Satan, and the old serpent is wiggling and squealing, and immediately we turn into the next section, which is fourfold of the benefits to the believer. Capricorn, the sea goat. No single sign has been twisted by devils or by Satan and his demons more than this one. The fertility rites, the turning of the message of the heavens into a worship of the creature, and all the abominations that Paul talked about have never been more fulfilled than on Capricorn. And yet Capricorn contains the most blessed message of atonement. The sea goat. You can tell as you look at it. The goat is beginning to pour out his life, and his hinder parts are crushing down, but suddenly they turn into the symbol of abundant life, the fish. And in that symbol you have the dying goat in death producing the life abundance of the fish. The surrounding signs to elaborate on this work of atonement is the arrow of righteousness that you can't see who sends it. It's sent by the invisible God. You can't find the one who shot it. But that arrow, the naked shaft of death, is the instrument of God's righteousness poured out in wrath on sin, that the dying goat as a sacrifice for our sins must absorb in order that the life resurrection, new life that he brings can come. He's pictured then as Aquila the eagle, pierced and falling. Immediately followed again by the picture of abundant life, the dolphin that leaps out of the sea, an ever-recurring expression of life. Immediately, because the subject is the benefits brought to the believers down here and the nature of the believers and those that he's chosen down here, that's a part of his work. You go from the atonement constellation to Aquarius, the man with the water pot. He's pouring out the life of the Spirit. Immediately the Decans around it, the southern fish, swimming in that outpouring of his life. The southern fish is in the stream of his life, becoming Pegasus, the winged horse, anointed with the Spirit, going forth with the good tidings, and becoming Cygnus, the swan who bears the cross on its wings and soars in victory in spite of carrying the cross. Immediately we go to the third one, Pisces. Two bound fishes. You won't find it being taught in the book exactly the same way that I do. Pisces is two bound fishes. Now I've moved along quickly. I'm going to stop for this one and show you a picture. Pisces pictures two fishes bound. Now, under the waterman, the fish, which is the church, Jesus has said, I'll make you fishes of men. The church that receives the life that he pours out, drinking at the fount, is not bound. As long as it says in the stream of his life-giving word and his life-giving spirit. Pisces shows two fish that are bound by their tails. One here, going this direction, the other are going north. None other than the symbol, in contrast to the church that's drinking at the fount of grace and truth, the two lost tribes, the divorced wife and the scattered wife, still in this world, bound by a band that ties them together. And that band is hooked in the neck of the sea monster. As you go from the fishes to the supporting decans, you have the band that ties them to this world. You have Andromeda, the chained woman, the condition on this earth. And you have Cephas, the crowned king. He is seated in heavenly places at the right hand of our Father. He is crowned. And those fish of his that did not accept him as Savior came to his own received him not. Remain bound down here in the symbols of Andromeda and the two fishes. And then we come to Aries, the ram. Now that's where I've been going the whole evening to try to get to that point, because we have seen it before. It is the symbol of the sacrifice for sin. Right on the band, that'd be the center of the room as we're going around the zodiacal equator, not the equator of the earth. If you were right on the beam, and I sighted being the earth through my camera, right at the dead center of the room of the heavens, the wall that surrounds us, I'd cut right across the ram, which is Aries. Now, you've got E. Raymond Capps' book in front of you. The decans that support the ram are three. The enthroned woman, the sea monster, and what a monster he is, and Perseus the breaker, the most revered and heroic of all these symbols of the heavens. Aries the ram, surrounded by the enthroned woman, the sea monster, and Perseus the breaker. Now what can these teach us? We're still in that section that has to do with the goings-on in relationship to his people, what the Redeemer has obtained for them. Now you've got capped. I'm going to read from you Joseph Seiss, The Gospel and the Stars, about Aries. Am I boring you? Worthy is the Lamb. He starts out with the text that was slain to receive power and riches and wisdom. The figure here is that of a vigorous ram. It is called Aries, which means the chief. Now, you may want to take some notes and write in the margin of Cap's book. You'll have some fun. It is called Aries, the chief, the head. You'll remember the distortion of the Nazis, the Aryan race. Aryan means the lordly, the chief, the supreme. So Christ is the chief, the head, and the Lord of his church, not the Nazis. Christ. In Syriac, well, let's talk about the English word ram. It means high, great, elevated, lifted up. Where do you think those rams that roam the high cliffs and high mountains got their name? In Syriac, the name is Amru, meaning the lamb. It is also called the branch. The Arabic calls this figure Al-Hamal, the sheep. The principal stars, and you know the constellation is made up of stars of different magnitudes. One of the good things about Capp's book, he sort of summarizes the stars. You ought to take a trip up here to the observatory. I'd recommend it. Yeah, it consists of 66 stars, only one of the first magnitude, two of the fourth, and so on. In Syriac, Amru, the lamb, the principal stars included are called Elnath, or Elnatik, and Al-Sheraton. Each of them mean, now these go back to the most ancient times. Here's a heaven full of stars. Why are these particular stars named from most ancient days as follows? It is the symbol of the ram who provides the victory of dedication and deliverance. And the stars from earliest antiquity. Nobody can tell you where these names came from. Elnath and Al-Sheraton. Elnath, Elnatik, Al-Sheraton, which mean respectively the wounded, the bruised, the slain. From earliest antiquity. We got people who lived 800-900 years in those days. God was the teacher of their grandfather. Enoch walked and talked with God over 300 years. That's a pretty good teacher. And nobody knows where these names came from. Yet, the ram's main stars mean the wounded, the bruised, the slain. And yet, the picture doesn't look like it at all. You've got to go back to Capricorn to see the wounding. Over the head of the figure is a triangle. Isn't that interesting? And its principal star bears a name signifying the head or the uplifted. Now, it's totally unreasonable to suppose that all this could have happened by mere accident. Some intelligent design by which the whole was arranged is behind it. And the entire presentation is in thorough accord with what the Scripture says concerning the seed of the woman. I don't have to bore you with it. Let me just show you something interesting. As they painted over the picture of Christ in that Islamic church, but you couldn't hide the picture behind it, mythology distorts and paints over the true message, but let's look at some of them and see if we can catch a glimpse of the truth behind. This noble and mysterious animal, the ram, in ancient mythology, was given by Nephele to her two children, Phrixus and Hele. When Ino, their mortal stepmother, was about to have them sacrificed to Jupiter, Nephele, to her two children, gave the ram to them. It was by seating themselves on the back of the lamb and clinging to its fleece that they were to make their escape. Nephele means the cloud. She is reputed the queen of Thebes, and Thebes was the house, city, or congregation of God. We thus have a cloud in symbol over God's house, and hey, I do not believe that mythology will lead you to God. Mythology is the distortion. But when you have the word, you can go behind the lie and find the truth that was always there. We thus have the cloud over God's house, or congregation, precisely as the Scriptures tell of the cloud manifesting to his ancient people. The two children of the cloud are therefore like the two fishes of the preceding sign. They were under the sentence of death. The lamb was furnished to these children from the same cloud of which they themselves are born. The safety of these children of the cloud rested exclusively in this lamb. Both of them, in fact, were safe and carried far aloft from evil Ino's reach and power, so long as they both continued firmly seated on this lamb. So, we see a distorted picture of the delivering power of the lamp. Heli, one of these cloud children, became giddy in the heavenly elevation to which she was lifted by this lamb. This is myth. Lost her hold upon his back and fell off into the sea. Thereafter called Hellespont or Helles Sea, the ancient name for the ocean. Phrixus, the other child of this mystic cloud seed, held on to the mystic lamb and was brought in safety to Colchis, the citadel of reconciliation, the city of refuge. Nephele's lamb was there sacrificed to Jupiter, as those who were saved by him would have been without him, as Christ, the true Ares, was sacrificed in our place and we escape. The myth has it, it was this lamb of Nephele that yielded the golden fleece that we hear so much about in mythology, which made him who possessed it the envy of kings, and which constituted the highest treasure to be found with the children of men. What an image of the greatest treasure of life, the righteous garment, clothing, the righteousness of Christ covering us, and we who wear it, beneficiaries of his sacrifice. It's worthy of remark that the Egyptians celebrated a sacred feast to the ram upon the entrance of the sun into the sign of Aries. Now, the distortions and the mythology has changed the truth into a lie, and they worship the creature instead of the Creator. But the message was there. Part of the surrounding decans, Cassiopeia, nothing less than a picture of the true Church of God lifted up out of all of its evils. The enthroned woman, seated in heavenly places, as in the previous passage, which pictured the two fishes bound, and I said a few Sundays ago, like it or lump it in your traditions, God's a polygamist, and always has been. Now, I ain't no Mormon, and I don't preach that we follow God in that godliness. Only God can handle three women. No man can. You better figure that out. Even the Mormons couldn't have done it if they hadn't got them in a desert place where they couldn't leave. Hey, I'm dead serious. God's a polygamist. He had two wives in the Old Testament. It's as clear as a bell. He had Israel and her treacherous sister Judah, and he was married to both of them. Now, it's bad enough to have two wives, but if they're both sisters, that compounds the problem. God had two of them. And he's going to marry a third one. Now, two of them are still chained down here because they wouldn't accept him. He's sitting on a throne. But we're drinking at the fount as the southern fish and seated in heavenly places with him as the enthroned woman. It's simple as that. To say much more about that is to adorn the obvious. In addition, down here is the sea monster. Let me talk about the glorified woman for just a moment. Her common name is Cassiopeia, the beautiful, the enthroned. Plushade derives the name by tracing its etymology as the boundary of Typhon's power, the delivered from all evil. Four stars of the third magnitude, which never set, form the seat upon which this woman sits. Just think about that for a moment. We are seated with Christ in heavenly places. The four stars that comprise the throne, which is our faith position, are stars which never set. I could preach for an hour on that. About 300 years ago, there occurred in this constellation a great mystery to astronomers. You want to know? You want to know what happened about 300 years ago? In this constellation, which is the type of the church in her faith position, not in that book. No, he's not in the one I gave you. Lucille, I've never seen you look so mean at me. I'm going to be nice. About 300 years ago, there occurred in this constellation what was a great mystery to astronomers. Oh, I don't know if I should tell you. About 300 years ago, there occurred in this constellation what was a great mystery to astronomers. A star, surpassing in brilliancy and splendor all the fixed stars, suddenly appeared on the 10th of November, 1572. And after shining in continuous glory for 16 months, disappeared and has never since been seen. Now, I'm going to skip the next paragraph and just go on. I mean, I got to save that next paragraph for some other time. Otherwise, I'll be here too long. Just gnash your teeth and get over it and we'll keep going. And if there is any one constellation of the sky or any figure among these celestial frescoes especially fitted to be the symbol and representative of the church, particularly in its enfranchised and glorified condition, its faith position, it's this. Look at its names. The first star marking the figure of this woman is called Shedar, which means the freed. And Rukbah and Dot al-Kursa, which signify the enthroned and the seated. Next to her is the glorious star-crowned enthroned king we just seen. While living by faith and seated on a throne, we still have to contend with Cetus, the sea monster. That miserable image of the devil on this earth. The largest of all the constellations, this miserable monster of the sea. A vast scaly beast with an enormous head, mouth, and front paws. The second Decan. This is the true Leviathan of Job and Isaiah. It is a downward constellation bordering on the lower regions. One of its characteristic stars, Myra, situated in the neck of the scaly monster, is the most variable and unsteady star in the entire heavens. From a star of the second magnitude, it dwindles away until it becomes invisible once in about every 300 days, and once it disappeared for four whole years. A striking symbol of the devious one, the arch deceiver. Its name, Myra, means the rebel. Why is it you don't find this monster called the Bruised? From earliest time, they've been identified. But that monster is connected and held by the same band that the enthroned king controls. He puts his two fish that are those tribes that rejected him in a bondage, but the same band also sets the limits on this monstrous cetus. God will not release control. Biggest miserable monster in the whole skies. But our enthroned king has got the leash on him. The same God that ties and those lost tribes as well as the kingdom of Judah, the divorced wife and the rejected dispersed one, think they truly are under God's band. So is old Cetus. The name of the first of the Cetus stars, Menkar, means the chained enemy. The second star, Diphda, means the overthrown and the thrust down. From earliest time, these names were attached to this monster. Listen to what God said in His Word. This is way back in that oldest book of the Bible, Job, chapter 41, verses 1 to 10. God's talking to Job. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook, or his tongue with the cord which thou lettest down? Can you reach down and grab Leviathan, the old sea monster's tongue, and pull it out? Can I put a hook into his nose or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Boy, you shout thinking about that. I like that. Will he make many supplications unto thee? Look at this monster. You think he doesn't beg anybody? Listen to me, Job. You know, Job decided he was going to criticize God. Can you draw out Leviathan with an hook? Can you put a hook into his nose or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Wilt thou take him for a servant forever? Wilt thou play with him as with a bird? Or wilt thou bind him for thy maid? Shall thy companions make a banquet of him? Shalt they part him among the merchants? Can thou fill his skin with barbed irons or his head with fish spears? Good old loving God's going to work him over. Behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? None is so fierce that dare stir him up. But he whom no man can take or bind, the Lamb has in his power. Isaiah prophesied of a day when, quote, the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. Isaiah 27:1. We read those passages and fail to understand that these Old Testament people understood the message and what it symbolized in the skies. The ram that provides the way of enthroning the church, conquering the sea monster, becomes Perseus in the third decan. And Perseus is the hero, like Hercules, who symbolizes the conquering work of that ram and the Lord that was slain, the breaker. He's the breaker that Micah says went before Israel and made a way for him. I'm going to read Sice again. Still greater vigor and animation in this whole scene is set out in the third accompanying side piece of the enthroned Lamb. Micah chapter 2 verses 12 and 13 prophesies of a time when the flock of God shall be gathered, their king pass before them, and the Lord on the head of them, and says that this shall be when, quote, the breaker is come up before them. The Lamb in the Apocalypse or Book of Revelation is the breaker of the seals, the breaker of apostate nations. He's the same in the second psalm. This breaker in these very acts is the precise picture in this constellation. It is the figure of a mighty man stepping with one foot on the brightest part of the Milky Way. You find him again. It is the figure of a mighty man stepping with one foot on the brightest part of the Milky Way, wearing a helmet on his head and wings on his feet, holding aloft a great sword in his right hand and carrying away the blood-dripping head of Gorgon in his left. See if you can get in close to that head in his left hand. You see it? Right there. That terrible head with serpents for hair. Now listen to his name. His name in the constellation is Peretz. Grecianized into Perses or Perseus. It means exactly what Micah's prophecy translates, the breaker. The name of the star in his left foot is Atik, which means he who breaks. The name of the brightest middle star in the figure is Al-Ghanib, the one who carries away, and Mirfak, who helps. And when Perseus comes to the meridian, the most brilliant portion of the starry heavens opens out its sublimest magnificence in the eastern hemisphere. Now again, the myths distort it. But behind the myth, the lie is the truth. Even the myths had one of the most beloved and admired of all the hero gods, Perseus. He was the son of the divine father, who came upon Danai in the form of a shower of gold. No sooner was he born than he and his mother were put into a chest and cast into the sea. But Jupiter so directed that they were rescued by the fishermen on the coast of one of the Cyclades and carried to the king, who treated them with great kindness and entrusted to them the care of the temple of the goddess of wisdom. Perseus' rising genius and great courage made him a favorite of the gods. At a great feast of the king, at which the nobles were expected to make some splendid present to their sovereign, Perseus, who was so specially indebted to the king's favors, not wishing to be behind the rest, or feebler in his expression than were his obligations, agreed to bring the head of Medusa, the only one of the three horrible Gorgons subject to mortality. This is myth. These Gorgons were fabled beings with bodies grown indissolubly together and covered with impenetrable scales. They had tusks like boars, yellow wings, and brazen hands, and were very dangerous. Their heads were full of serpents in place of hair, and their very looks had power to turn to stone anyone on whom they fixed their gaze. To equip Perseus for his expedition, Pluto lent him his helmet, which had the power of rendering the wearer invisible. Minerva furnished him with her buckler, resplendent as a polished mirror. Mercury gave him wings for his feet and a diamond sword for his hand. Thus furnished, he mounted into the air. Led by the goddess of wisdom, he came upon the tangled monsters. He, grasping the same in his left hand, he again mounted into the air. And over Libya's sands his airy journey sped, the gory drops distilled as swift he flew, and from each drop envenomed serpents grew. By this victory, the myth has it, he was rendered immortal, took his place among the stars, ever holding fast the reeking head of Gorgon, and it was on his return from this brave deed that he saw the beautiful Andromeda chained to the rock, the chained woman, and the terrible monster of the sea advancing to devour her, on condition that she should become his wife. He broke her chains, plunged his sword into the monster that sought her life, fought off and turned to stone the tyrant Phineas, who sought to prevent the wedding, and made Andromeda his bride, begetting many worthy sons and daughters, and by varied administrations of miraculous power, changing portions of the earth and its governments and rulers, returning the times to bless the countries that honored him. Myth, to be sure. But as the centaur, the two-natured one, was the good, a sister of mankind, disliked, not approved, but coming to heal and to teach and to help and giving his life for him, as the virgin was pure, the myth still portrayed the hero in Perseus, the heavenly symbol of Christ the Breaker, who delivers from the chains of bondage in this world and makes her his wife and takes the keys of death, hell, and the grave. And the serpent forever appears in the evil side of the spectrum. No natural events in the seasons or in the history of man could ever serve as a foundation for such a story as this. And I want you to get If God Be For Us and track it up, Joe, on the tape. Here is a divine human son begotten of a golden shower from the deity, a child of affliction. I'm reading Sice again now. A child of affliction and persecution from his very birth, but predestined by the heavenly powers to live and triumph. The seed of the woman, the lamb that was slain, going forward at the head of his people as the breaker now, bringing death and destruction to the monsters of evil, setting wrong captives free and joining them to himself in glory everlasting. There's nothing else anywhere that will adequately account for the existence of this story but the record in Revelation of what Christ has done and is doing. That we might understand this figure is still further manifest in the facts and names and the reeking snake-covered head grasped for the hero. Medusa means the trodden underfoot. The name of the principal star in this Gorgon head, Al-Ghul. You shouldn't have trouble with that word. We have a cognate in it. Contracted into Algol, which means the evil spirit. The same is also a variable star, like Myra. It changes about every 3 days from a star of the second magnitude to one of the fourth. So the stars in the head of the Gorgon means the trodden underfoot in its name. The stars mean the evil spirit, and they are variable, deceptive stars. Changing from the second to one of the fourth magnitude, and doing it every 3.5 hours. Rosh Satan and Al-One are other names of the stars in this head, which means Satan's head, the weakened, and the subdued. The invincible subduer and breaker is none other than the lamb, the biblical Peretz, the Persian Berkshuash, taking to himself his great power and enforcing his saving dominion and authority for the full redemption of his people. So ends the second segment of four, and we come to what Joseph Sice calls the Day of the Lord. Taurus the bull charges on the scene, but we're in another section of the heavens when we come to that. If I put you to sleep, don't call me. But if you're alive and awake, and you want me to go ahead and finish these, not tonight, most likely. I got another word or two to say. But I can just leave the stars and let you figure out the rest of it, or I can go to the kingdom portion, the last four, to the triumphant Leo the lion, who comes as the Lion of Judah. Only God could hurl in the magnitude of space the revelation from heaven of the wrath of God against all ungodliness, and it's always been there. The pyramid reached up and grabbed it and mapped it in its rock innards. And God, through prophets and shadows and diverse ways, spoke. But in these last days is spoken unto us by His Son, and the literal hypostasis or substance of God struck a tent in human flesh and became the revelation of God. And I don't need, I've said many times, I can take just one book of this Bible and preach the rest of my life on it. I don't need anything but one book. Don't care which one you give me out of the 66. I can preach the rest of my life on it. Every time I preach through a book of the Bible, you that have listened to me know I preach the whole Bible using that one book as a window to look at it. But to a world that looks on and to a scientific world that would crowd God out, as the Song of Asher declares it. The God of the forefront was there before they got to the corner. And God's not going to fall off of his throne because some smart aleck thinks he's discovered some new truth. God was there all the time. I don't need to dwell on the stars all my life. I've got 8 years preaching this book. I can have a few weeks talking about the stars. My fundamental message is God's in control, and that means we're in good hands.